You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Slate's Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Smith & Noble, featuring custom window treatments handcrafted to your personal style, design, and color preferences. Get 20% off your window treatments, plus a free in-home consultation, when you go to smithandnoble.com/xx. And by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code XX at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. And by MeUndies, featuring the All of Me collection. 4 different styles of underwear made from breathable, all-natural, modal fabric. MeUndies come with a money-back guarantee, and right now get 20% off your first order plus free shipping when you go to MeUndies.com/XX. That's MeUndies.com/DOUBLEX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Double X Gab Fest for Thursday, June 25th, the Cover Up and Summer edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and the Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get going today, we got a great response to our suggestion that we discuss classic movies with lady themes. And so we are going to begin that. Our first discussion is going to be of The Women. Says June, it has to be the 1939 version, not the 2008 remake, because June is like that. She also says it's available for $2.99 rental on Amazon. It's a Joan Crawford movie, and she is a woman whose catty friends talk her into a divorce. So we're excited about this. We're also going to post on our Facebook page other movie suggestions that listeners have sent us, some of our own, and we'll decide along the way in the summer which ones we want to do, but The Women will be for next time. Sound good, everyone?
Sounds fab.
Super pumped.
Okay, before we begin, we'd like to turn to a little bit of business. June.
So the Supreme Court are going to rule on same-sex marriage in the next couple of weeks. And you can join the writers and editors of Outward, that's, as you know, Slate's LGBTQ blog, to discuss same-sex marriage and much more live on stage in New York on Monday, July 13th. Outward's J. Brian Lauda, Mark Stern, oh, and me, June Thomas, will also welcome two special guests. We're going to have Evan Wolfson, the attorney considered by many to be the architect of legal same-sex marriage, and Ted Allen of the Food Network shows Chopped and All-Star Academy, and you might remember him as a cast member on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. He'll be on hand to discuss the state of gay stereotypes in the media. And audience members will have a chance to interact with us and to pose their very own Ask a Homo questions. So if you're in New York City on Monday, July 13th, please come to City Winery. The event is from 8 to 9:30, but doors open at 6. For tickets, go to slate.com/NYC Outward, and Slate Plus members get 30% off their ticket purchase. That's slate.com/NYC Outward.
Okay, excellent. All right, so our three topics for today. First, the summer dress code. Summer used to be a time for spaghetti straps and short skirts, but apparently not anymore, says a New York Times article. We discuss why. Second, women's prisons. Orange is the New Black is back. The culture seems more broadly obsessed with women in prison lately. What is it really like on the inside, and what have we learned? Third, the novelist Sheila Hetty is going to join us for our last segment, where she, for a change, interviews us. And we also talk about the new popular podcast, The Mystery Show. Okay, the summer dress code. I should begin by asking you guys what you're wearing. But wait, let me introduce the topic first. A trigger warning. I'm going to have to use the word male gaze here. I really don't see how we can avoid it in this topic. But this recent trend story in the New York Times claims that women are now covering up in the summer, or as novelist Amy Sohn writes, choosing not to dress for a... say it with me, man's gaze, even when the weather seems to dictate the bearing of skin. I have no idea if this is true because I do not live in Brooklyn, but it does lead to a broader question, which is how is a dignified woman, and particularly a woman of a certain age, say like my age or June's age, supposed to dress for summer? So you, Brooklyn, first let's just get that first question out of the way. Is it true, as she writes, that there is nary a stiletto and miniskirt in sight, or is that, you know, New York Times trendy exaggeration?
Definitely not stilettos and miniskirts. I think that has largely gone away in this fashion moment. But I think the subset of girls, women, kind of girls, it was young women, Sohn was writing about are very North Brooklyn, which I realize... could not
our readers
be,
are going to like,
know,
the listeners are going to murder us.
I could not
like,
be,
I can't believe you just said North
could
Brooklyn.
Not be a more annoying distinction for me to draw right now. I live in South Brooklyn, just putting that out there. But North Brooklyn is like Williamsburg and Greenpoint. It's people who are younger and very fashion forward, fashion obsessed. And so, yeah, my sister lives there. And so I'm there quite a bit walking around. This is real there. There are women just wearing sort of like witchy long ensembles that just like look like pretty uncomfortable for the summer weather. I don't know. June, is what about Park Slope? Should we talk about the Park Slope fashion? Just really complicate this?
Oh, Park Slope. In Park Slope, maybe because I just literally don't leave the house much. I see people who dress like me, which is basically I've been dressing like a teenage boy since I was a teenage girl. And I don't really like to expose myself. I really like, I'm wearing short sleeves now, which I'm actually wearing a shirt over a t-shirt, but it's a short sleeve shirt that I'm wearing over the top, and I feel really exposed.
It's got sailor stripes. It's very jaunty.
I do like a stripy shirt, but I don't like, I don't like having my outlines visible.
Huh.
And I really feel uncomfortable even with my lower arms exposed.
Hmm. Why do you think that is?
I think either I was in a recent life, a woman of cover, or I think that perhaps I'm just uncomfortable. Maybe I have body issues. I don't know. But I've always, even when I was like super skinny, I always felt uncomfortable with being having my flesh exposed. It's just not.
And do you associate that with modesty or dysmorphia, or like what's
no,
the emotion?
I just,
nothing. Just
it's, no,
style.
It's, or just like a weird me thing. I mean, I guess there's a little bit of those things. Like, it's not about being ogled. I've never been ogled in my life. It's not about that.
June, I'm ogling you right now.
Right
now. You're not seeing it?
Right now. I know. It's crazy.
I'm female gazing you.
It's not about that. It's just like a comfort thing. I don't like, I don't know, maybe it's a judgment thing. I don't even know. It's so deeply ingrained and so visceral that I can't really pick it apart.
It's a fashion statement, right? You, along with these girls in North Brooklyn,
yes,
are making a statement against the excesses of the mid-aughts when Paris Hilton and Britney Spears were the fashion icons. And now everyone wants to, you know, dress in these architectural drapey shapes and want to just cover up. That's what you and these girls are doing, right?
Noreen, it's like you're looking inside my brain. It's spooky.
So here's my question about this method of summer dressing. I understand where it's coming from, sort of, but it just seems pretty uncomfortable. You said, like, these girls are saying, oh, I'm not dressing for the male gaze, I'm dressing for myself. If you're dressing for yourself and you're swaddling yourself in a heavy overcoat and socks with your sandals in the summer, I don't know that you're dressing for yourself. You might be dressing for other girls. You might be dressing for street photographers. You might be dressing for, you know, a New York Times style reporter who just happens to come along Bedford Avenue looking for trends to catalog. But I don't think you're dressing for yourself. To me, in the summer, when you're dressing for yourself, it's just like you throw on something easy and cool. That's...
Well, it did. I mean, this is such a mean thing to say, but it did. The language around this, and we'll dissect it in a moment, just sounded like burqa feminism to me. You know, like, I'm covering up. This is just what I like to do. And then you're looking at the thing and thinking, well, aren't you hot? You know, you're just having the very practical thoughts. But before we get there, what are the feminist elements? So that this trend piece did portray this as a moment of empowerment for a couple of reasons. Like, one is that you're covering your skin. It's like a, you know, it's like a protest against sexiness. As you said, I'm not showing my cleavage, I'm not showing my legs. That was the burqa feminism part. The second was women dressing for women, which I think women among themselves have always said, oh, I dress for myself, I dress for self-expression. But now it seems to be a cultural thing. Like, since Sheila Hedy is coming on the show later, she and a couple of her friends, Heidi Julewitz, Leanne Shapton, wrote a book called Women in Clothes. I don't know if any of you have seen this. So the book is basically dozens and dozens of women. Some of them are young, some of them are older, some of them are famous, some of them are totally unknown, talking about their clothes, what the outfits they choose and what they mean to them. And like, the point of the book is even our most basic clothing choices can give us confidence, show the connection between our appearance and our habits of mind, express our values and our politics, bond us with friends, and function as armor or disguise. So now this is like a formal way of thinking about dressing, as opposed to just a kind of subterranean how women talk amongst themselves.
In what way?
Because it's now we have decided that we dress for self-expression and for ourselves.
But people have always been doing that. I think, you know, from the dawn of time. And there are a bunch of French semioticians who've made a cottage industry of studying that for decades now, right?
So then what's the moment about? Is the moment like drawing a line in the sand and saying, look, I'm telling you, I'm showing you in this forceful, covered up way that I'm dressing for myself and that it has nothing to do with you, Mr. Male Gaze?
Well, first of all, I think that whole sentence about the male gaze, which was so weird because I just have never believed that women... So let's just read that sentence again. In Brooklyn, many young women today choose not to dress for a man's gaze, even when the weather seems to dictate the baring of skin. Like, I just reject fundamentally the idea that when women go out baring skin, they're doing it for the male gaze. I mean, maybe I am deluding myself, but I'd never have thought that's what they were doing it for. I mean, I think they are often feeling great about their bodies. Like, you know, in Manhattan, not so much in Brooklyn, perhaps, but in Manhattan, you see a lot of women who have the body that is the body that everyone in the Western world, at least, is craving, and they bear it. And I mean, I totally understand why they're doing it, because they're proud of themselves. They feel good about themselves. Maybe it's about attracting the male gaze, too. But I think it's, I really sincerely think that it's more about them feeling good about the body, which might be a result of like the genetic lottery or might be a lot of hard work, probably a combination of both. And I just, I don't know, that seems perfectly reasonable to me. And I clearly there are places like in the office, there are certain ways that you are recommended to dress or comport yourself in terms of, you know, modesty or whatever. But I don't know, I just really fundamentally seems to me that these are people wear what they're comfortable with. And if they're comfortable with their bodies, they often bear their bodies. But is it really about attracting the male gaze?
I also think summer dressing for women and men, but women get more freedom in this kind of thing, is just an expression of how much easier and more fun summer is. You know, people who wear black all winter are suddenly wearing fun explosions of color. Summer is just easier. And to me, that's sort of all it is. If you wear a sleeveless dress, it's just like you throw it on and it's easier. But can I bring up something that might unite our discussion of these young women interested in covering up and how to dress as an age appropriately as you get older, which is Eileen Fisher.
Mm.
So one of my colleagues... One of my colleagues at New York Magazine about a year ago, Molly Fisher, wrote what I thought was a great article on The Cut in praise of Eileen Fisher. And, you know, there's an association of this brand as being kind of for older women, sort of distinguished older women into architectural lines. And Molly pointed out that actually it's at this moment very fashion forward. It's well-made clothing. And why not put it on yourself when you are still young and beautiful? And, like, you know, why not show it off in that way? And you guys, well, at least you, Hannah, have this allergic reaction to Eileen Fisher.
Whereas I dream of it. To me, it's like it's my aspirational look. Like, I would love to be one of those poised, elegant, you know, just professional. And it's what I dream of. I see women sort of sporting that look, and I think, oh my goodness, you would be like the greatest therapist ever, and I want to be you.
Yeah, totally. You know?
And I go
Can
in
you
there,
be my
and I,
mom.
You know, but my mother did not dress like that, so like that's okay. I don't have that particular baggage, so it's all right.
My mom does wear Eileen Fisher, so I do have that. But she looks great in it. It's beautiful clothing.
I have so many resentments against this line of conversation.
What
bring
are they?
Start. Yeah. Okay. The very first one is that there's a way in which young women can appropriate middle-aged fashion and thus make the actually middle-aged feel foolish. There are certain clothing lines, for example, high-waisted pants, which we now all wear, used to be called mom jeans. When you walk into, you know, say like a bohemian like style place like Free People, it's very confusing and insulting because Free People in my, you know, life trajectory is maternity clothes. And yet, like, I can't walk into Free People and sort of buy something because it's slightly embarrassing. So I have to be like, oh, I'm just getting something for my daughter, even though, like, you know, they made these clothes so that they fit me now. So it's all very confusing. So I feel like for young people to also appropriate Eileen Fisher is just irritating. And the second thing about Eileen Fisher is, like, I can't help it. I understand, like, Janet Malcolm wrote about Eileen Fisher, Molly Fisher did. It's like, Eileen Fisher is cool. I get that. That's been drilled into my head. It feels like resignation to me. Like, I have given up and I am not going to try to do interesting things anymore. I'm just going to buy, like, very plain clothes that are very well made and convince myself that they're stylish because they're really expensive.
No, it's not about expensive, though, because they're not that expensive. I mean, they're not cheap, but they're not that expensive. But I think mostly it's like you are resisting serenity.
Yes.
Because, first of all, I reject your description of those clothing. It's not about giving up. You always say that about things that are comfortable. You said it once about short hair. Like, it's.
I did. I love
did.
Short hair.
Well,
oh, really?
I remember I did a riposte to you in Double X. But it's, I don't know, that whole idea of resignation, you resign yourself to comfort?
No. I'm totally pro-comfortable. I never wear uncomfortable clothes at all. I just resign. It's the not having to choose. That's the thing that I submit. It's the fact that, like, everything is laid out for you in this mix and match kind of buffet of, you know, colors that all sort of go together. It just feels like it has taken the effort out of your hands. And maybe that's okay. It's just, to me, getting dressed is interesting. Like, trying things is interesting. That's not to say I always get it right, but, like, it's just kind of fun, whereas I've sort of turned it over to somebody else, you know?
Oh.
Sometimes you want that. Yeah. You know, you just want... I bought an Eileen Fisher dress 2 weeks ago. I can't hide that fact any longer.
Wow.
And I've worn it, like, 3 times since. It's just, you throw it on, put on some shoes. I think we're in different places with our dressing right now, Hannah. But you, on Slate, wrote a defense of dowdiness and the power that one can find in dowdiness and in invisibility. I feel like you are contradicting yourself here.
I am, totally. I was just playing.
God.
You know what? I'm going to go buy myself an Eileen Fisher dress. I'm just going to do it and wear it around, and I will report back. Like, maybe it's going to be so awesome. Like, maybe I don't know. Maybe it'll fit really beautifully and it'll just be perfect. And then I'll go to sleep and die. just kidding. Okay. All right. That's enough of that. Well, let's move on to our second topic, women in prison. But before we do that, we'd like to thank our loyal sponsor, Smith & Noble, the window treatment company. If you, like me, are happy to stare at bare windows for months because you're too lazy to do otherwise, then this company is for you. As I've said before, I recently wrecked and redid my house, and by the time I got to the windows, I was totally spent. Thank God for Smith & Noble, because I could order very quickly. I ordered honeycomb shades for the kids, heavier drapery for the bedroom. It was all modern and very easy. Smith & Noble will send an expert designer to your house, works with you one-on-one to design custom window treatments that are perfect for you. They measure, they order, they install. Double X listeners get 20% off on window treatments. For our special offer, go to smithandnoble.com/XX. So that's Smith and then NOBLE.com/XX. The letters XX, and get your 20% off. Okay, women in prison. The new season of Orange is the New Black opens with a Mother's Day episode where the children come to visit. We see the women hug their kids, cry over them, ignore them, and ultimately be cruelly separated from them. As the number of women in prison generally skyrockets, we are beginning to reckon with how we just can't treat them exactly like men, because a lot of them have kids and are the sole caregivers. So, why are we so interested at this moment in women in prison? So first, let's start by talking about Orange is the New Black. Did you guys see that episode?
Yes, I watched all of them the first weekend it was available.
I still have not had my Orange is the New Black binge for this season. So no, I have not.
But you will.
I will.
I'm sure. So in Orange is the New Black, one of the characters is pregnant, about to have her baby. And there was a great story in The Atlantic by the wonderful Sarah Yeager called Prison Born, about what happens to babies who are born to mothers behind bars. And this has become a big debate because there are so many more women in prison these days, and very few of them are married. And so you have this problem of what to do with the babies. So when you guys read about the prisons which are trying the experiment, or have been for a long time in some cases, of raising the children behind bars, did it seem Dickensian to you?
To me, it seemed like finally in America there's a sort of a social welfare program that isn't being denied to people. I mean, I know that it sounds ridiculous to think that there's a benefit to a child growing up in a place where the things that they're exposed to are so limited, where they never go outside, where they're essentially literally behind bars. But just that opportunity to bond with a parent, the opportunity to spend quality time with your mom when your mom is not kind of scraping together a million jobs and having to find childcare on a very small budget, like that to me seemed like that's great for those kids. As crazy as I know that sounds, it seemed like from a pure bonding and, you know, having that attachment period, almost one of the best options for low-income women. And I know how that sounds, but it really felt that way to me.
Yeah, I was just so fascinated in the section in this article about, you know, the evidence that children who are with their mothers in prison versus children who are in foster care, the kids just by being with their mothers develop at a much more rapid pace. They speak, they're, you know, learn to use the bathroom, all those things. And it was just almost like a pure controlled experiment for mm-hmm. what simply access to your parent will give you. And it made me believe that, okay, maybe these attachment parents in some ways aren't as crazy as I believed.
And we should say that in most cases, the time that mothers are allowed to be with their kids is 12 months, or if they're going to be released in the next 6 months, they can petition to have, you know, to be together until they're released. So it's a relatively short time. But, you know, in some of the studies that the Atlantic article cited, even kids who later were separated from their moms because their moms were still behind bars, they were doing better than kids who had never had that time with, you know, close contact with a parent.
But this is still, you know, not a widely, I mean, it is used in a bunch of prisons, but we, at New York Magazine, we've been working for a little while on a package on Rikers that will be out next week. And at Rikers, for instance, they have a nursery, they have this program, but it's routinely half empty. But they reject about half the applications for various reasons, like if a woman has a past substance abuse problems, if she has had behavioral issues in jail, they won't allow the kid to come into the nursery with her. So it is, you know, a program that you almost have to be this perfectly behaved inmate in order to access, I think, in a lot of places.
Well, I have no realism about prisons. I've been to a women's prison, but I haven't spent a lot of time in prisons, obviously. So this sounds completely unrealistic. But it seems to me, first of all, a decent place to, all you do with a small baby anyway is like stay inside. So if there's lots of other small babies and you have nothing else to do but pay attention to the baby, it doesn't seem like the worst thing ever. The thing that was fascinating to me about the story is A, how historically women used to have their children in prisons with them because there was this like slightly retrograde idea that it would bring out their maternal side. I thought that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I think about that now. Like, isn't saying that having a baby in prison both softens the mother and is good for the baby kind of taking advantage of certain kind of female maternal stereotypes? Like, why wouldn't it be just as good for dads, you know?
But maybe it's just true.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of fathers who are in jail aren't as connected to their children in just a number of different ways.
And I guess especially infants.
Mm-hmm.
The most interesting thing, though, was Germany. This idea that in Germany there are prisons where they actually let women who are imprisoned go home, you know, feed their children dinner, put them to bed, and then come back and sleep in the prison. That seemed to me truly enlightened. And it also seemed to me like it takes advantage of a completely different idea of self and personality and what a person is. Because in America, we have effectively this idea that, you know, people who are prisoners. That's what they are. They are criminals who have committed a crime and they are in jail. Whereas this other idea understands personality or self in a completely different way, which is that you can have many selves in a person. You can have a person who committed a crime who's still perfectly capable of being a parent and being out in the world. That seemed really enlightened to me.
It's also, though, in the United States these days where prisons have migrated out to the country, doesn't seem particularly practical to, you know, in the U.S. context. And that obviously, again, is a big problem with mothers and fathers, but you know, since we're focusing on mothers who are in jail or in prison, in that it's really, you know, as more and more people are incarcerated a long distance from their families or whoever is taking care of their kids, that it's very hard for them to have even basic visitation. And so, you know, again, that lack of bonding is really, you know, more and more pronounced, it seems.
In Slate this week, there was a great story by Justin Peters about relationships between inmates and guards and how there are different kinds. You know, somebody did a study in which they divided the different types of relationships. Some of them are exploitative, but some of them seem to have a genuine aspect to them. Like, mm-hmm. It was answering the question of whether there can be true love between prisons and guards.
One of the pieces that I found most fascinating about Justin Peters' piece was just this idea that it can actually be helpful to the guard in terms of ending harassment. You know, that there's nothing another correctional officer can do if a female guard is being, you know, subjected to verbal abuse. You know, they might just say, well, that's just part of the job. There's really nothing I can do. And there probably isn't. Whereas, you know, he had some examples of cases where women got involved with prisoners and the abuse ended because the prisoner had the power to end it. And, you know, he also pointed out that often the COs and the inmates are from, if not identical backgrounds, very similar backgrounds. You know, that actually there's, you know, a natural kinship. I mean, yes, we've divided them into two different groups of people. Some have uniforms and batons and has the power to punish the other group, but they're basically from the same kinds of places and backgrounds often.
Yeah, that's like how the motorcycle gangs turn out to be all ex-military guys, you know? They're like disorder and order at different moments in their life.
And it turns out, actually, that at least in Rikers, which is my only area of prison expertise at the moment, the majority of guards are women, which I was sort of shocked by. And particularly as you move up the ranks, wardens are something like 75% female, which is
in a men's prison.
There's an
why
end, there I don't know there's an end well now actually
low pay right
well no it's high pay
oh
you get a ton of overtime, you can make well into six figures with your overtime just as a basic corrections officer. But also now, at least in this prison, and I think across the country, there's an attempt to sort of white collarize these jobs, and so you need a certain number of college credits, which I think women are more likely than men to have. And also maybe just like, well, yeah, just cut me off there.
Oh, my God. That would have been a great chapter in my book, End of Men. That is so interesting that women are now prison guards. I had no idea. All right. Well, when we bomb out as podcast people, we can all go work at Rikers.
I'll need somebody to drive me there. Can you guys give me a ride?
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Okay, cool.
All right, let's move on to our next topic, which is a discussion with Sheila Hetty. Before we do that, we would like to thank our sponsor, Squarespace. It's a site that helps you start your own website, makes it extremely easy to do that. I have an ongoing saga with my son. This week is very exciting because he is at computer programming sleepaway camp. I know you guys are all jealous about that. He spends a week in computer programming camp nearby, and he is showing his friends his website, which they all really like, his dorm mate especially. They have lots of different templates and choices. It's an easy interface, access to images, and there's a feature called cover pages, which makes it intuitive, and you can figure it out in very little time. It looks good on phones, and they have a 24/7 support line that you can access via live chat and email. $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. If you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code XXDOUBLEX to get 10% off your first purchase. And we thank Squarespace for their support. And now I'm so excited to do our next segment. We are going to talk with Sheila Hetty, who's a Canadian writer and editor, one of my absolute favorite novelists. She wrote the novel How Should a Person Be, also Ticknor, both of which I absolutely love, and Women in Clothes. And she and I got to emailing, and we came up with a funny idea for a segment, which is that Sheila is going to interview us. And then we're going to talk about the mystery show, about which we all have strong feelings. And for that segment, we're going to bring on a mystery guest. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Nice to be here and not in my kitchen listening to you guys while I'm washing the dishes.
And it is really weird for us to be interviewed rather than interviewing, but we're looking forward to it.
I was curious about learning about the backstage of this podcast. So do you have a sense of your audience when you're doing this? Are you trying to not bore them? Are you trying to, you know, simulate sort of a, like your illustration, like an around the table conversation, and they're the fourth person? I mean, how do you relate to the idea of an audience?
We are definitely aware of them because we're sometimes afraid, or I'm afraid might be too strong a word, but we're wary of things, saying some things that we know will kind of attract responses that may not be terribly positive. So
do you think that's a feminist thing? Like, do you think the other podcasts are equally afraid? Like, is there something that the Culture Gab Fest is worried about saying because they might offend fans of, you know,
I mean, I know that there are things
Jim Jarmusch
like
or they, something.
Well, I know, for example, that there aren't really particularly fans of like superhero movies. And so people who like those kind of movies get tired of the sort of a negative approach. So, you know, I think there are things like that that everybody's aware of. Or, you know, one of the things that we often have in mind is that we don't want to all agree on something because that would just be dull.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes we try to like play the provocateur, although we're not that good at it.
Right.
You know, none of us will actually usually go the full hog and just like really, you know, do the debate team thing where you pretend to believe something you don't believe.
Yeah, we are still playing ourselves.
Maybe we should try that one time, because that if my friends complain about the podcast, that is a common complaint. And Sheila, I'm curious to see what you think about this, is that we don't argue quite enough. Like David, my husband David, on the Political Gabfest, sometimes people will come up to me and say, you know, essentially your husband's kind of a jerk. And I'll say, no, he's not. He just plays a jerk on the podcast. Like that's his persona. And he does it to kind of rile up debate and make, you know, Emily angry, or like get a really strong opinion out of John. Like he's acting much more on his podcast than most of us are. Sheila, do you feel a lack of, this is so exciting, this is like we're doing a focus group. Sheila, do you feel like you would like us to agree more or be less kind of girly apologetic?
I've never thought of you guys as girly apologetic.
Thank you.
I like that there's not this artificial heightened tension, argumentation. I don't get why that's exciting to listen to so much for me. I don't want to have this artificial like pounding in my heart when I'm listening to a podcast. I just, what I like about this show so much, and the reason I wrote you over at Twitter, Hannah, was just to say that it feels close to conversations that I have with friends, though we don't talk about pop culture so much, maybe. But the other thing that I like about it is that it's like having a conversation with a friend, except you don't have that other part, that little part of your brain when you're actually participating in a conversation, which is waiting to have your turn to speak, thinking of what you're going to say. So it's like being in the conversation without those additional sort of anxieties and plans. And you don't listen as well when you're part of a conversation as when you're when you're listening to a podcast and there's no way you can ever speak.
Right. Has anybody ever had the experience? I listen to podcasts in bed and sometimes, you know, I fall asleep and then I wake up and it's almost like semi still in a dream. And I'm arguing with people, but they're not listening. And I get so mad. And whenever it happens, it's the worst feeling because it just brings up all of my deep-seated, you know, self-doubts. And people aren't listening to me and all of that stuff. And it makes me crazy. Has that ever happened to anyone else? No.
Okay. No, because that's not when I listen to podcasts. I just had two interesting thoughts. One is, I will say, it's gotten more intimate for me as time goes on and more pleasurable to do the podcast because we're a fairly new trio, relatively new, right? Even though the podcast is not new. And I feel like we've relaxed into a kind of dynamic, which for me makes the conversations very satisfying and allows me to forget about the audience a lot of the time. So I genuinely am talking to the two of you, and that's very pleasurable. And for you, Sheila, I was thinking it's kind of like your novels, how you just describe the experience of listening to the podcast, which is like it's you, but it's not really you. Like you're there, but you're only kind of half there. Am I describing the feeling correctly?
I don't really know what you mean because like maybe that's your experience of my novels, but that's not my experience of writing my novels. I mean, obviously, I'm completely there.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, for years of your life.
Yes.
Hours at the computer, you've been there.
But like the character is you, but it's not, you know what I mean? It's semi-you.
Well, I feel like the character is way more fictional than your personas on this show. Or than my persona for, you know, if there even is so much of a persona being here in the studio with June and Noreen. Like, I don't see that there's a huge or relevant correspondence between like the Sheila and How Should a Person Be and like the Sheila sitting here or the Sheila coming through the podcast. That's really a fictional voice. This is just me talking to you guys, trying to be a little bit more concise maybe than I would be off mic. But I wanted to ask, do you guys listen to every podcast?
You mean that we have our own?
Yeah.
I listen to most of them. Sometimes for whatever reason, I don't have the opportunity all the time, but I generally do listen to them.
You do?
Yeah. I don't. I do sometimes if there's something that's stuck in my mind and I want to hear how it actually played out. And like, I've just been going over it in my mind, like, how dumb did I sound or whatever? Or like, did Anne edit that out? So then sometimes I'll listen, but the truth is I can't really stand the sound of my own voice. And so it like is kind of a painful hour. And usually podcasts are very pleasurable.
I never do. I never do. I always want to. And I'm like you, Noreen, I cannot stand the sound of my own voice. I don't understand what that's about. I haven't, you know, subjected that to any therapy. I don't understand it.
It's very common. We don't all have June's like mellifluous, perfect voice.
or you don't have my narcissism. That's the reason I listen is because I want to hear, like, I admit I do like, oh, did I say something dumb? Did Anne fix that? But also like, how was I? I was great. So it is totally narcissistic.
So you usually feel good after you listen. You're like, that was wonderful.
Pretty much.
Do you feel like you were the best, June, when you
Well, listened? I couldn't speak to that, Hannah.
Therapy session is getting aggressive now.
Have you guys hung out outside of this context? Do you email about your personal lives, or do you pretty much keep your relationship for the studio?
Well, I'm going to reveal something that...
I know exactly what you're going to reveal.
A personal revelation, which is that on New Year, Hannah...
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. apparently Noreen's got one too. On New Year, Hannah sent us texts that were really like friendly and intimate, and I thought she'd sent it to the wrong person. Because, like, I love Hannah, but we don't, like, tell each other that. We don't send, you know, we don't text each other. We don't like...
She's like, I love you guys.
Yeah. We don't send, you know, sweet little notes to each other. And so I really thought she'd sent it to the wrong person. And I even wrote back and said, Hannah, I think this was meant for someone.
I was so hurt by that, June. I was like, what the fuck? I'm just an American. Like, this is how we roll in America. Like, we don't make these distinctions. Like, I was just in a mood of, like, love and, you know, happiness. I was actually in Canada, Sheila. You'd be happy to know
when
mood waved over me. And I sent everyone the text. And then June was like, what? Who's this again?
You're making it sound like we don't like each other.
No, we love each other.
June and I have gotten dinner in Brooklyn. Hannah and I have hung out. We've all three hung out. Just yesterday, we were emailing about Eileen Fisher and whether that is actually cool to wear. I am pro. They are con.
No. I wish I could be. Yeah, I love those clothes. I go around and it puts me in a fantasy life of how the person I would be if I wore those clothes.
We had a meeting recently where we all got together in New York. And yes, it was a businessy meeting. But I think it was the first time we had all met together. Well, like we knew each other. But it was the first time I feel like we all really met to discuss the podcast and come up with an agenda. And to me, something broke after that. Like it became much more kind of loose and fun and directed. And that had a really big impact for me on the feeling of the show.
I always forget that Hannah's not in the room with you guys. I don't think I even realized that until very late in my listening.
Good.
Yes.
So maybe we should turn our conversation to the mystery show. The reason we want to bring this up in this conversation is because Sheila brought it up in our emails, and also because our mystery guest and I have been having like huge fights about it. And it turns out that reflects the public conversation about it, because as someone pointed out to me, the ratings for the show are kind of ones and fives. Like it's a love it or hate it kind of show. So I introduce our mystery guest, David Plotz, familiar to Slate podcast listeners. Hi, David.
Hi, sweetie.
Don't call me that. In this show, because we're about to fight. Okay, Sheila, why don't you start and say what you think of the show?
Okay, well, it's a show produced by Starley Kine, who's a former This American Life contributor, and she takes somebody's mystery. So the one that sticks most in my mind is the second one, where this woman who's a writer, a fiction writer, published a book. Almost nobody read it, except she saw a paparazzi photo of Britney Spears holding the book. So her mystery question was, how did Britney Spears get my book? And I guess a sub-question was, did she even like it? So Starley went and tried to find the answer to that. So that's the sort of narrative conceit of the show, or the structure. But to me, what I liked about the show is these conversations that she has with the people she meets along the way. So she calls a telemarketer, not a telemarketer, she calls somebody from like a ticketing agency for the Britney Spears concert, and they get into like a 6-minute conversation about the meaning of life and his life. And to me, that's the heart of the show. And I have to say, like, I sort of know Starley a bit, and I feel like that's one of her life talents, is getting people to open up. And I feel like she's built a show around her greatest skill. And to me, the art I like is the art that's built around whatever that person really has that's original and different from what other people can do. And I think that's sort of the genius of the show, is that she's created a structure that highlights that. The mystery is cool to see, but I don't think that's what the show's about.
To me, her greatest skill is definitely not Google, because I mean, it's kind of remarkable to have gotten as far as she has in the world.
Oh my gosh.
To be as incapable of discovering basic facts about people as she seems to be.
Sheila, ask me if my husband is a jerk on the podcast.
Hannah sort of gave a version of what you just said. Also eloquently, and what you just said is also eloquent, and it's very generous to Starley Kine. I find it infuriating. Infuriating, with the third episode in particular, in which it's a long shaggy dog story about a lost belt buckle that someone has that he wants to return to its owner. Now, the belt buckle, spoiler, guys, anyone listening who hasn't listened to the third episode, I'm about to spoil the third episode. Belt buckle says to Hans Jordi, Hansjordi. So what follows is 45 minutes of Starley Kine attempting to find Hans Jordi. 45 minutes in radio time, which presumably is also like months in actual time. And I found Hans Jordi in 4 seconds with a Google search. The idea that the journey is the message, or the journey is the thing we should celebrate, and watching her run into all of these people is beautiful, and her chance encounters with people and the small connection she makes. You know, I see some of it, and there are moments of mild transcendence in there. But for the most part, it's just infuriating to know that all of this could have been solved, all of this could have been taken care of, had she just bothered to Google it.
No,
but wait a minute. Like, that makes, to me, I had no idea. I didn't Google Hans Jordi, but that makes the show even better to me. Like, I believed it, and that's the fiction, and that's wonderful. And I don't think that makes the show worse. That makes her more of a... like more of a better storyteller and more of an artist to me. You could just say, well, this play's message is, you know, be good to other people or something like that. Why not just give the message? You're missing all the art and the artifice. It's about the art and the artifice, not the fact that Hans Jordi can be found on the internet.
Yeah, it's like she's kind of a magician. Like that story she tells you at the beginning about the reason she launched the show, because she and her sister looked inside a box and there was nothing inside that box, and thus started her lifelong, you know, quest to be Encyclopedia Brown and solve mysteries. Now, you know, the trick of that story is that it's good that there was nothing in that box. If there had been treasure in that box, then there would be no lifelong appreciation of mystery and journey. And I think I agree. I feel like,
well, those are two,
yes,
different
there are
things.
Many
mystery
shows that
and journey are different things.
Okay,
the mystery are the mysteries they have are they're much more trivial than anything Encyclopedia Brown ever dealt
but
with.
But trivial.
Encyclopedia Brown found the coins. He found the Civil War coin. You know, he solved, you know, whether Bugs Meany had stolen that bicycle.
Okay,
he did
but
that.
Once you've read one Encyclopedia Round, you've read all 50,000 of them. They're always the same. It's like Bugs Meany is never going to win. The thing that's great about Starley's show is that, first of all, I thought this last show was less successful to me than the Britney Spears show. She did lose a little bit of my trust because they were actually incredibly easy to find. And I wish there had been a wink about that. Like any reporter knows that if you're on the trail of somebody with those two names are extremely unusual, you're very happy because it's easy to find names that are unusual. If she had hinted to me in some way that she knew that they were easy to find, and yet I'm not saying she has to say this, but if she had hinted to me that she was going to take me on this journey nonetheless, I think I would have been a little bit happier. The Britney Spears show, on the other hand, I thought was like marvelous and fabulous. And she took me the whole way, and the accidental encounters were beautiful and really opened up my mind to the idea that like every person has a story and that there are stories everywhere if you just look for them, and that, you know, that we have narratives and about people and about celebrities that just aren't true. I mean, the show had so much kind of mood and beauty to it that it made me want to listen to more.
See, I'm more in David's camp. Sheila, it's lovely of you to see that she has that skill, and it's clear that she can get people to talk, but I didn't want to hear them. To me, there's
yes.
something about radio that is like, you know that every art has its artifice. And so with audio, you know that whatever happens, whatever you know, if you don't have tape, you don't have anything. And so I understand why she calls up bookstores to ask about a book when that's not how you... All the people in the bookstores are just doing the same thing. They're all looking at the same database. It's pointless. It's pointless to do that. It's pointless... But she's doing it so she can get audio, and then she's kind of exploiting the conversations, which is a beautiful skill that she has, to entertain us. And, you know, that's great. There are all those 5-star things. For me, it's something that is not something that I would enjoy, but...
I agree with you that she's exploiting the conversations. Like the moment where she talks to the telemarketer, the guy at the ticket booth selling the Britney Spears tickets, and he's like, are you just this beautiful person that calls up people that work on telephones and makes their lives amazing? And Starley laughs and doesn't say, actually, no, I'm a reporter and I'm, or not even a reporter, I'm making a podcast, and I'm exploiting you as you say it, June.
She must have gotten consent, though, right?
Oh, yeah, she must have after the fact. Yeah.
No, but she is a beautiful person who's doing that, because you who listens to that show will think twice next time you call a telemarketer.
No,
like,
no,
she's spreading the love.
Can I posit that there is a reporter-editor divide in the room, or a writer-editor divide? Not that everyone here doesn't do both, but I think there's sort of two ways of seeing this process. So there are these side journeys that you go on as a reporter, and you're talking to someone on the phone, and you know you should be getting back to what you're supposed to actually be talking about. But there's this weird other thing they've just said, and you want to go for it. And sometimes you do, and sometimes it leads nowhere, and sometimes it's transcendent. And I think she's just totally leaning into that in a way that's really pleasurable. And then I see what you guys are saying, which is like, this is self-indulgent. This is not the point. This is not the assignment.
Mm-hmm.
I can see so much fat here to cut. Like, there's just like two ways of coming at it. Well, and then I have another argument, which is that the mystery she's talking about is actually the people along the way and not the mystery at the end. That's the way I saw it.
Yeah.
You, but I'm not I'm literal minded. First of all, can I just object as a human being? Noreen, to you using that phrase "lean in." Can you stop doing that?
I use it all the time.
It's neither here nor there.
It's David, really
that's
bad.
Not relevant.
That was your editing, by the way.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, I think of this as almost like, you know how you meet a great doctor and you discover, or you meet a doctor and you discover this doctor is a plastic surgeon, or you meet some really smart person, discover they're working at a hedge fund. You think like, what a fucking waste. Like, here's this great mind. The thing that I object most vigorously to with Mystery Show is that Starley Kine and the resources of Gimlet, and I love what Gimlet is doing. I think it is great. I love Alex and Matt. I think the show startup that they have is one of my favorite, maybe it's my favorite podcast ever. But they have incredible talent, incredible ability. They know how to create stories to build drama into an hour of radio, and they're doing that with Mystery Show, and that's what makes me so furious about it, because I feel like this is energy that could be so much better deployed in the This American Life world, where you tackle something which actually is a subject of significance, and you spend time on a subject of significance and make people think about the world in a different way rather than this fucking noodling.
Oh my God, stop.
This is a novelist versus
yeah, why do you assume limited
world?
Resources? I think the world is there's an endless diversity of voices. This one is especially original, and I think its larger purpose is to teach us not to be like you. That is, not to be instrumental and, you know, direct and to the point all the time. We're on this cusp where podcasting is about to become like everything else, which is we demand it to be fast and we demand it to hold our attention, and watch podcasts are going to get shorter and shorter and shorter, and they're going to get like blogs, where Starley is doing it like, slow down, you know, slow down and notice what you're doing along the way. And I really appreciate that.
I feel compelled to point out that David Plotz, in my experience, which is certainly much less extensive than some other people's on this podcast, is one of those people who cannot stop asking questions. He's very much Starley Kine-ish in a way. Like, I'm sure every time he takes his car in to be fixed, he ends up having
Actually, no, actually, June, you're being very generous to me, and I don't deserve it, because I would distinguish between what I do, which is that I'm an information miner, from what Sheila and Hannah are talking about, which is the human connection. And I actually think that I do admire that Starley Kine is going for that. I actually don't think she achieves it, with the exception of the telecharge thing, which infuriated me for other reasons, because Starley Kine appeared to be so self-aggrandizing in that conversation, in all these conversations. That was the one where you could say, oh, she actually has some human connection. I actually think that is maybe the only, because it's the only one you guys have come back to in 3 hours of this. It's the only one
What about when she gives the belt to Hans Jordy? Like, that was moving to me. I thought the journey on that one was a little less interesting, and I would have edited some of it out, but I thought the very end was quite lovely. Like, this belt was really meaningful to him and had meant something in his life and represented to him a version of himself that, now that he's older, he'd kind of lost connection with. And the idea that there are these objects that move around the world and can mean very deep things to different people and come alive in that way, I thought was very beautiful.
Well, she has this whole Manic Pixie Dream Girl radio persona, which is kind of maddening. If you listen to the ads,
yeah,
like, her persona in the ads is also Manic Pixie Dream Girl, and it is.
Well, Noreen, since you made the writer-editor distinction, and I'm, you know, mostly a writer but have done editing, that was as I was listening to the last show, that was my last, like, if I was the editor, I would think, you know, just kind of whenever you feel those moments of Manic Pixie Dream Girl coming on, just kind of edit them a little bit, and you know, it just with a little editing, you know, I think I'm so in favor of the show philosophically and spiritually and emotionally, but just a little editing would be great. Sheila, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah.
What about me?
I forgot. David, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you, David.
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry I was such a jerk. It got me so worked up.
Listening. Are you a jerk, or are you playing one on the podcast?
Who knows?
It's a mystery.
Ask Hannah.
It's a mystery. Okay. Let's move on to our recommendations, but before we do, we'd like to thank our new sponsor, MeUndies, which is, guess what? A company that sells underwear. And this fabulous company actually sent us underwear, which is very apt to our first topic about summer dressing, because it's the kind of underwear that's like, which kind of like lady mood are you in this morning? So there's some underwear that's really boxy that, you know, is like boy short kind of underwear that when I took it out of the package, my then Brazilian au pair was like, oh, I think they sent you the wrong one. This is for a boy. And I was like, no, dude, these are boy undies for a cool girl. And then they have thongs and they're really soft and awesome. And I'm really embarrassed to be talking about underwear. So one of you has to say something about your experience wearing the underwear. You just tried on your first pair and they feel, fill in the blank, one of you.
Great.
They did. They're actually really soft. I love them. And they're cute.
Totally.
And now I have to say, and David loved them too. All right. Oh my God. Right now, when you go to MeUndies.com, say it like a pirate, MEUNDIES.com/XX, DOUBLEX, you'll get 20% off your first order of thongs, bikinis, boy shorts, or, I'm going to say it, cheeky briefs from the All of Me collection plus free shipping. That's MeUndies.com/XX for 20% off your first purchase. So let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen Malone, you first.
I have been reading a book called The Odd Woman in the City by Vivian Gornick. And she is well known for her memoir, Fierce Attachments, of her childhood in New York. And this is sort of an update to that. It's a sort of slim book, very much inside her head as a person who lives in New York City and just thinks about her relationship to her friends, her relationship to the city. And she's very thoughtful, and it's funny in an unexpected way for something that's sort of like, not that feminists can't be funny. I feel like I just put my foot in my mouth
in
eight different ways. no, I mean, she's kind of like a leftist of the old school, but she's also very funny.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to do like a love song to Sheila Hedy here. Two things I want to recommend by her. One is this Women in Clothes paperback book that I was talking about. I love this book. I keep it on my radiator where my Gretchen Rubin book used to be. And I just read like one entry at a time every once in a while. And they're just, I find them just so completely charming. There's like a whole section where people give her pictures of their moms. In the favorite outfit. So it's like mom on the beach when she was 17 or whatever. And they're just so full of nostalgia and beauty. I really love this book. The second thing I want to talk about is that Sheila Hedy started a podcast, which is very weird and cool and experimental in the Hedy way. And it's like she's having you listen as she's figuring out how to do the podcast. So it's very much like her book, which is to say she's kind of figuring out what should a podcast be. And it's very philosophical and quite funny. And in the first one, she talks to her brother and they have such a like a sweet and funny relationship. So anyway, I really liked it. It's on her website. It's SheilaHedy.net, and her name is spelled SHEILAHETI. June, how about you this week?
Well, I had a great time this weekend watching Catastrophe, which I just came across on Amazon Prime. It's a 6-episode comedy, a British show that aired on Channel 4, but Amazon have brought it to America. It's Rob Delaney, the American comedian and Twitter wit, and Sharon Horgan, an Irish actress and writer. And they wrote and star in this show about a couple who meet in a bar, have sex, and then she gets pregnant. And it's a difficult pregnancy, and their relationship continues in that weird sort of, I don't know, almost contested way, but it's really, really funny. It's a very difficult pregnancy and it's really funny. And I know that it sounds like those two things wouldn't go together, but it's the kind of very real somehow and dirty and flirty and just really, really funny show that is more than just an empty laugh. And it is a lot of, I really did laugh out loud. It's unusually funny. It's a little bit like the FX show You're the Worst, but with older people and with the actors themselves having written it, which is also great.
Oh, that sounds great. Excellent. Well, thank you to our producer, Ann Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our intern, Jesse Chasen-Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. For more information about this show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Leave us comments, queries, responses, ideas for our next show on the Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, or you can email us at XXGabFest@slate.com. Also, subscribe on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For Noreen and June, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks. And don't forget to watch The Women.
Round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.